The Two Towers, Cassette 10.
The hobbits sat down again, but they said nothing to one another of their thoughts and doubts. Close by, just under the dappling shadow of the dark bay trees, two men remained on guard. They took off their masks now and again to cool them as the day heat grew, and Frodo saw that they were goodly men, pale-skinned, dark of hair, with grey eyes and faces sad and proud. They spoke together in soft voices, at first using the common speech, but after the manner of older days, and then changing to another language of their own. To his amazement, as he listened, Frodo became aware that it was the elven tongue that they spoke, or one but little different, and he looked at them with wonder, for he knew then that they must be Dunedain of the south, men of the line of the lords of Westerness. After a while he spoke to them, but they were slow and cautious in answering. They named themselves Mablung and Damrod, soldiers of Gondor, and they were rangers of Ithilien, for they were descended from folk who lived in Ithilien at one time, before it was overrun. From such men the Lord Denethor chose his forayers, who crossed the Andun secretly, how or where they would not say, to harry the orcs and other enemies that roamed between the Ethelduath and the river. "It is close on 10 leagues hence to the east shore of Anduin," said Mablung, "and we seldom come so far afield. But we have a new errand on this journey. We come to ambush the men of Harad. Curse them."
"Aye, curse the Southrons," said Damrod. "'Tis said that there were dealings of old between Gondor and the kingdoms of the Harad in the far south, though there was never friendship. In those days our bounds were away south beyond the mouths of Anduin, and Umbar, the nearest of their realms, acknowledged our sway. But that is long since. 'Tis many lives of men since any passed to or fro between us. Now of late we've learned that the enemy has been among them, and they are gone over to him, or back to him. They were ever ready to his will, as have so many also in the east. I doubt not that the days of Gondor are numbered, and the walls of Minas Tirith are doomed, so great is his strength and malice. But still, we will not sit idle and let him do all as he would," said Mablung. "These cursed Southrons come now marching up the ancient roads to swell the hosts of the Dark Tower, yea, up the very roads that craft of Gondor made, and they go ever more heedlessly, we learn, thinking that the power of their new master is great enough, so that the mere shadow of his hills will protect them. We come to teach them another lesson. Great strength of them was reported to us some days ago, marching north. One of their regiments is due, by our reckoning, to pass by, sometime ere noon, up on the road above, where it passes through the Cloven Way. The road may pass, but they shall not while Faramir is captain. He leads now in all perilous ventures, but his life is charmed, or fate spares him for some other end." Their talk died down into a listening silence. All seemed still and watchful. Sam, crouched by the edge of the fernbrake, peered out. With his keen hobbit eyes, he saw that many more men were about. He could see them stealing up the slopes, singly or in long files, keeping always to the shade of grove or thicket, or crawling, hardly visible in their brown and green raiment, through grass and a brake. All were hooded and masked, and had gauntlets on their hands, and were armed like Faramir and his companions. Before long they had all passed and vanished. The sun rose till it neared the south. The shadows shrank. "I wonder where that dratted Gollum is," thought Sam, as he crawled back into deeper shade. "He stands a fair chance of being spitted for an orc, or of being roasted by the yellow face, but I fancy he'll look after himself." He lay down beside Frodo and began to doze. He woke, thinking that he had heard horns blowing. He sat up. It was now high noon. The guards stood alert and tense in the shadow of the trees. Suddenly the horns rang out louder, and beyond mistake from above, over the top of the slope. Sam thought that he heard cries and wild shouting also, but the sound was faint, as if it came out of some distant cave.
Then presently the noise of fighting broke out near at hand, just above their hiding place. He could hear plainly the ringing grate of steel on steel, the clang of sword on iron cap, the dull beat of blade on shield. Men were yelling and screaming, and one clear, loud voice was calling, "Gondor! Gondor!"
"It sounds like 100 blacksmiths all smithying together," said Sam to Frodo. "They're as near as I want them now."
But the noise grew closer.
"They're coming," cried Damrod. "See, some of the Southrons have broken from the trap and are flying from the road. There they go, our men after them, and the captain leading."
Sam, eager to see more, went now and joined the guards. He scrambled a little way up into one of the larger of the bay trees. For a moment he caught a glimpse of swarthy men in red, running down the slope some way off, with green-clad warriors leaping after them, hewing them down as they fled. Arrows were thick in the air. Then suddenly, straight over the rim of their sheltering bank, a man fell, crashing through the slender trees, nearly on top of them. He came to rest in the fern a few feet away, face downward, green arrow feathers sticking from his neck below a golden collar. His scarlet robes were tattered, his corslet of overlapping brazen plates was rent and hewn, his black plaits of hair, braided with gold, were drenched with blood, his brown hand still clutched the hilt of a broken sword. It was Sam's first view of a battle of men against men, and he did not like it much. He was glad that he could not see the dead face. He wondered what the man's name was, and where he came from, and if he was really evil at heart, or what lies or threats had led him on the long march from his home, and if he would not really rather have stayed there in peace. All in a flash of thought, which was quickly driven from his mind. For just as Mablung stepped towards the fallen body, there was a new noise, great crying and shouting. Amidst it, Sam heard a shrill bellowing or trumpeting, and then a great thudding and bumping, like huge rams dinning on the ground.
"Where? Where?" cried Damrod to his companion. "May the Valar turn him aside. Mumak! Mumak!"
To his astonishment and terror and lasting delight, Sam saw a vast shape crash out of the trees and come careering down the slope. Big as a house, much bigger than a house, it looked to him, a grey-clad moving hill. Fear and wonder, maybe, enlarged him in the hobbit's eyes, but the Mumak of Harad was indeed a beast of vast bulk, and the like of him does not walk now in Middle-earth. His kin that live still in latter days are but memories of his girth and majesty. On he came, straight towards the watchers, and then swerved aside in the nick of time, passing only a few yards away, rocking the ground beneath their feet. His great legs like trees, enormous sail-like ears spread out, long snout upraised like a huge serpent about to strike, his small red eyes raging. His upturned horn-like tusks were bound with bands of gold and dripping with blood. His trappings of scarlet and gold flapped about him in wild tatters. The ruins of what seemed a very war tower lay upon his heaving back, smashed in his furious passage through the woods, and high upon his neck still desperately clung a tiny figure, the body of a mighty warrior, a giant among the Swertings. On the great beast thundered, blundering in blind wrath through pool and thicket. Arrows skipped and snapped harmlessly about the triple hide of his flanks. Men of both sides fled before him, but many he overtook and crushed to the ground. Soon he was lost to view, still trumpeting and stamping far away. What became of him, Sam never heard. Whether he escaped to roam the wild for a time, until he perished far from his home or was trapped in some deep pit, or whether he raged on until he plunged in the great river and was swallowed up. Sam drew a deep breath.
"An olifant it was," he said. "So there are olifants, and I've seen one. What a life! But no one at home will ever believe me. Well, if that's over, I'll have a bit of sleep."
"Sleep while you may," said Mablung. "But the captain will return, if he's unhurt, and when he comes we shall depart swiftly. We shall be pursued as soon as news of our deed reaches the enemy, and that will not be long."
"Go quietly when you must," said Sam.
No need to disturb my sleep. I was walking all night. Mablung laughed.
I don't think the captain will leave you here, Master Samwise, he said. But you shall see.
Chapter 5 The Window on the West. It seemed to Sam that he had only dozed for a few minutes when he awoke to find that it was late afternoon and Faramir had come back. He had brought many men with him. Indeed, all the survivors of the foray were now gathered on the slope nearby, 200 or 300 strong. They sat in a wide semicircle, between the arms of which Faramir was seated on the ground, whilst Frodo stood before him. It looked strangely like the trial of a prisoner. Sam crept out from the fern, but no one paid any attention to him, and he placed himself at the end of the rows of men, where he could see and hear all that was going on. He watched and listened intently, ready to dash to his master's aid if needed. He could see Faramir's face, which was now unmasked. It was stern and commanding, and a keen wit lay behind his searching glance. Doubt was in the grey eyes that gazed steadily at Frodo. Sam soon became aware that the captain was not satisfied with Frodo's account of himself at several points. What part he had to play in the company that set out from Rivendell? Why he had left Boromir, and where he was now going. In particular, he returned often to Isildur's bane. Plainly he saw that Frodo was concealing from him some matter of great importance. But it was at the coming of the halfling that Isildur's bane should waken, or so one must read the words, he insisted. If then you are the halfling that was named, doubtless you brought this thing, whatever it may be, to the council of which you speak, and there Boromir saw it. Do you deny it? Frodo made no answer. So, said Faramir, I wish then to learn from you more of it, for what concerns Boromir concerns me. An orc arrow slew Isildur, so far as old tales tell, but orc arrows are plenty, and the sight of one would not be taken as a sign of doom by Boromir of Gondor. Had you this thing in keeping? It is hidden, you say. But is not that because you choose to hide it? No, not because I choose, answered Frodo. It does not belong to me. It does not belong to any mortal, great or small, though if any would claim it, it would be Aragorn, son of Arathorn, whom I named, the leader of our company from Moria to Rauros. Why so, and not Boromir, prince of the city that the sons of Elendil founded? Because Aragorn is descended in direct lineage, father to father, from Isildur, Elendil's son himself, and the sword that he bears was Elendil's sword. A murmur of astonishment ran through all the ring of men. Some cried aloud, The sword of Elendil! The sword of Elendil comes to Minas Tirith! Great tidings! But Faramir's face was unmoved. Maybe, he said. But so great a claim will need to be established, and clear proofs will be required, should this Aragorn ever come to Minas Tirith. He had not come, nor any of your company, when I set out 6 days ago. Boromir was satisfied of that claim, said Frodo. Indeed, if Boromir were here, he would answer all your questions. And since he was already at Rauros many days back, and intended then to go straight to your city, if you return, you may soon learn the answers there. My part in the company was known to him, as to all the others, for it was appointed to me by Elrond of Imladris himself before the whole council. On that errand I came into this country. But it is not mine to reveal to any outside the company. Yet those who claim to oppose the enemy would do well not to hinder it. Frodo's tone was proud, whatever he felt, and Sam approved of it, but it did not appease Faramir. So, he said, you bid me mind my own affairs, and get me back home, and let you be. Boromir will tell all, when he comes. When he comes, say you. Were you a friend of Boromir's? Vividly before Frodo's mind came the memory of Boromir's assault upon him, and for a moment he hesitated. Faramir's eyes watching him grew harder. Boromir was a valiant member of our company, said Frodo at length. Yes, I was his friend, for my part. Faramir smiled grimly. Then you would grieve to learn that Boromir is dead?
I would grieve indeed, said Frodo. Then, catching the look in Faramir's eyes, he faltered.
Dead? He said. Do you mean that he is dead, and that you knew it? You've been trying to trap me in words, playing with me, or are you now trying to snare me with a falsehood?
I would not snare even an orc with a falsehood, said Faramir.
How then did he die?
And how do you know of it?
Since you say that none of the company had reached the city when you left.
As to the manner of his death, I had hoped that his friend and companion would tell me how it was.
But he was alive and strong when we parted, and he lives still for all that I know, though surely there are many perils in the world.
Many indeed, said Faramir, and treachery not the least.
Sam had been getting more and more impatient and angry at this conversation. These last words were more than he could bear, and bursting into the middle of the ring, he strode up to his master's side.
"Begging your pardon, Mr. Frodo," he said, "but this has gone on long enough. He's no right to talk to you so. After all you've been through, as much for his good and for all these great men as for anyone else. See here, Captain."
He planted himself squarely in front of Faramir, his hands on his hips, and a look on his face as if he was addressing a young hobbit who had offered him what he called sauce when questioned about visits to the orchard. There was some murmuring, but also some grins on the faces of the men looking on. The sight of their captain sitting on the ground, and eye to eye with a young hobbit, legs well apart, bristling with wrath, was one beyond their experience.
"See here," he said, "what are you driving at? Let's come to the point before all the orcs of Mordor come down on us. If you think my master murdered this Boromir and then ran away, you've got no sense. But say it, and have done. And then let us know what you mean to do about it. But it's a pity that folk as talk about fighting the enemy can't let others do their bit in their own way without interfering. He'd be mighty pleased if he could see you now. Think he'd got a new friend, he would."
"Patience," said Faramir, but without anger. "Do not speak before your master, whose wit is greater than yours, and I do not need any to teach me of our peril. Even so, I spare a brief time in order to judge justly in a hard matter. Were I as hasty as you, I might have slain you long ago. For I am commanded to slay all whom I find in this land without the leave of the Lord of Gondor. But I do not slay man or beast needlessly, and not gladly, even when it is needed. Neither do I talk in vain. So be comforted. Sit by your master and be silent."
Sam sat down heavily with a red face. Faramir turned to Frodo again.
"You asked, how do I know that the son of Denethor is dead?
Tidings of death of many wings. Night oft brings news to near kindred," he said. "Boromir was my brother." A shadow of sorrow passed over his face. "Do you remember aught of special mark that the Lord Boromir bore with him among his gear?" Frodo thought for a moment, fearing some further trap, and wondering how this debate would turn in the end. He had hardly saved the ring from the proud grasp of Boromir, and how he would fare now among so many men, warlike and strong, he did not know. Yet he felt in his heart that Faramir, though he was much like his brother in looks, was a man less self-regarding, both sterner and wiser. "I remember that Boromir bore a horn," he said at last.
"You remember well, and as one who has in truth seen him," said Faramir. "Then maybe you can see it in your mind's eye, a great horn of the wild ox of the east, bound with silver and written with ancient characters. That horn the eldest son of our house has borne for many generations, and it is said that if it be blown at need, anywhere within the bounds of Gondor, as the realm was of old, its voice will not pass unheeded. 5 days ere I set out on this adventure, 11 days ago at about this hour of the day, I heard the blowing of that horn. From the northward it seemed, but dim, as if it were but an echo in the mind.
a boding of ill, we thought it, my father and I, for no tidings had we heard of Boromir since he went away, and no watcher on our borders had seen him pass. And on the third night after, another and a stranger thing befell me. I sat at night by the waters of Anduin, in the grey dark, under the young, pale moon, watching the ever-moving stream, and the sad reeds were rustling. So do we ever watch the shores near Osgiliath, which our enemies now partly hold, and issue from it to harry our lands. But that night all the world slept at the midnight hour. Then I saw, or it seemed that I saw, a boat floating on the water, glimmering grey, a small boat of a strong fashion with a high prow, and there was none to row or steer it. An awe fell on me, for a pale light was round it. But I rose and went to the bank, and began to walk out into the stream, for I was drawn towards it. Then the boat turned towards me, and stayed its pace, and floated slowly by within my hand's reach, yet I durst not handle it. It waded deep, as if it were heavily burdened, and it seemed to me, as it passed under my gaze, that it was almost filled with clear water, from which came the light, and lapped in the water a warrior lay asleep.